This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Don't know if you've noticed it, but the world's going through a lot of major changes right now. I'm not sure you could call them watershed events, but nevertheless, I think the world is becoming probably one of the most dangerous places since World War II, if we take it back that far. Welcome to The Big Picture this week here on the Financial Sense News Hour. You know, last week on the program, recall that we did a show about weak economic growth, and it looks like the next policy move, not just on the part of our central bank, the Federal Reserve, but on the part of other central banks, will be more helicopter drops after the money is printed to pay for more stimulus to keep the economy going. The real question is, now that we're on this freight train, can we actually stop it? And the answer is probably not. If you notice, there were two different visions that came out of the two conventions. Both of them agree that, you know, the GDP is really, well, they didn't say the GDP was really bad. That would have upset a few things. But anyway, we know GDP's not very good. Jobs have not been very good either. And there are two versions of how to achieve the new change. One is a move to socialism and to redistribute wealth. That would be the Democratic platform. The second would be tax cuts. This would be Donald Trump's platform. I guess the common denominator between the two is that we would now spend it on infrastructure. I guess, Jim, somebody finally got their ear. Remember when President Obama was dumping all this money and stimulus back right after the crisis? We were spending it on all sorts of stuff rather than on infrastructure, and we knew already that the infrastructure, which had been in place since Eisenhower put in the road systems and everything, was crumbling, and we needed to be able to fix that. But they didn't spend it on that. That's one thing that Roosevelt did well. We spent it on infrastructure projects during the New Deal. We still have some of that here today, like the Grand Coulee Dam and Hoover Dam and places like that. So that's the difference between the two. They're two radically different economic worldviews. The question is, which one is going to win out? Now, everything we discussed last week, helicopter drops, Friday's GDP number is being 60% below expectations, and also, according to the financial press, the worst and slowest economic recovery since World War II. We were all discussing here on the program last week, and a lot of it came about in more ample form this week. But, you know, guess what? You are not hearing that in the bulk of the media. So here's the question. We keep talking about this potential for a recession next year, but even deeper than that, are we headed for another deep financial crisis? And that's the subject of what we're discussing for the first part of The Big Picture today.
Well, let's begin with helicopter drops, because we broached this subject a couple of weeks ago, and we spent some time last week talking about it. And John, it was like every single day this week, there were articles that came out that confirmed everything we talked about on the show last week. For example, we talked about helicopter drops. There was an article this week that these helicopter drop ideas are going global, and it'll probably take place first in Japan. There was other articles talking about that the U.S. is finally abandoning any idea of controlling deficits. In other words, if you look at the Republican platform or you look at the Democratic platform, there is no talk anywhere of bringing this debt that has been doubling now. You realize it's been doubling with every single president. George Bush doubled the debt. Obama doubled the debt. And both parties have abandoned any idea of any kind of fiscal restraints. In fact, both parties are talking about fiscal stimulus. And as we've seen here in the last 2 weeks, you got two different versions. One would be using the private sector to stimulate growth, and one would be using the government in the form of moving to socialism to stimulate growth. So there's two different views in terms of how to kickstarting the economy. But the one that caught everybody's attention and the markets off surprise on Friday is everybody was expecting that economic growth was picking up a little bit in the second quarter. The PMIs and the leading LEIs have been mixed. Well, Friday's second quarter GDP number, the experts thought it was going to come in at 2.6%. It came in at 1.2%, which is interesting because the Fed met this week and they were raising expectations for a September rate hike and possibility of everybody would think, well, if they didn't go with September, they would go with the December. John, the December rate hike is coming into question. You just got weak economic growth in the first quarter. You've got the weakening job growth. The unemployment claims are rising. And you just got the second GDP number for the second quarter, and it came in at 1.2% versus 2.6. So all the economic news coming out every single day this week, we're going to cover some of these before we get on to why eventually we're going towards a bigger financial crisis that will be bigger than the last one. It's all a matter of confidence, which is the topic. But everything that we talked about has been highlighted in articles. And let's begin with one that came out early in the week. It was the IMF. And the IMF is calling for, and the word, I quote, underline, urgent G20 action to shore up vulnerable global economies. And the IMF has weakened or lowered its economic growth forecast. Canada's economy is now in recession. We got their GDP numbers, and the economy contracted by 0.6%. That came out on Friday, along with the U.S. GDP number, 1.2%. And the IMF is saying, look, you can't just be one person that's going to do the helicopter drops. It's got to be all of you. So basically, the IMF is calling for all G20 countries to stimulate fiscal spending, because the IMF basically is admitting that monetary policy isn't working. And in addition to that, they downgraded once again their forecast for global growth. And if you take a look, there was articles that came out this week that Canada and UK are moving towards fiscal stimulus, especially now that Canada's economy is now in recession, which is one of the, if you take a look at the Canadian election with Trudeau, Trudeau was promising to stimulate government spending. And the other thing that came out of the IMF is basically said, look, Federal Reserve, what the heck are you guys talking about raising interest rates when growth is slowing around the economy in several major economies like Canada now, and also some countries in Europe and also Japan are currently in recession? What are you guys thinking? And so that was an article that came out with the IMF, and that came out this week with Christine Lagarde basically saying, look, you guys better do something here. Do you really need to wait as politicians till we're in another full-blown crisis? Head it off now, because we're heading into one if you don't.
Well, and you can see how we're headed in this direction, too, because in both conventions, for what I watched of them, when they weren't busy bashing on the opposite candidate, they were telling you how they were going to spend money for their various programs. And I kept sitting in the living room going, and you're going to pay for this how? You know?
Yeah, and there was an article this week. It was in the Wall Street Journal, and it was called "The Debate Over U.S. Debt Changes Its Tone." And the gist of it is, don't expect to hear any new calls for reduced spending from either party. Populism is going global. Whether you're looking at the movement within the Democratic Party with Bernie Sanders and also Hillary Clinton moving far to the left, or even the Republican platform, and it's not just here. It's in Europe. It's in Japan. So populism is urging governments to act, because if you don't act, I mean, the electorate is angry. They're feeling the impact of slow economic growth, stagnant wages, and the growing threat of war. We're actually in one. We just don't want to admit it. So gone are the grand bargains that we spent the last 3 or 4 years talking about, slashing the debt, reining in government spending. Now there's all kinds of clarion calls to spend money on infrastructure. That was probably the common thread between both the Republicans and Democrats. You're talking about, like, for example, if you take the Republican version of spending, they're talking about health care, border security, national defense. If you take a look at the Democrats, they're talking about the environment, higher taxes, expanding entitlements, and reducing defense spending at a time that we're heading towards war, which was amazing. In fact, there was an interview, and John, maybe we can play that clip. It's just absolutely astounding of how uninformed the media has kept the American public, because they asked one of the attendees at the conference what he thought about controlling ISIS.
Can you name one good thing about Donald Trump? What about you? One good thing.
He is against free trade agreements, which is pretty cool.
Trump wants to defeat ISIS.
Maybe he does, maybe he doesn't. I'm not familiar enough with him.
Don't you want to defeat ISIS?
Probably I do. I don't approve of ISIS tactics, but I don't know anything about their ideology. I don't know what ISIS thinks about global warming.
You're worried about what ISIS thinks about global warming?
I'd be interested in their views on global warming.
That clip originated from a Waters World segment of Bill O'Reilly's show on Fox News. I always love these interviews, Jim, with people because, you know, here you are in a war situation where you have an organization such as ISIS perpetrating acts of terror on the West, and somebody says, well, I don't know if we're going to should try to defeat them or not, because I don't know what their views on climate change are. And it reminds me of Churchill. Churchill said at one time that your faith in democratic government can be destroyed by 5 minutes of conversation with the average voter. So when you hear this stuff, you go, yeah, I see why that is. And most of these people never came up in the conventions. You know, they all cheering for this or that. They don't understand these things that are headed towards us.
Well, part of it is because the media is, there's almost a blackout. They focus on the irrelevant. It's more like he said, she said. I mean, they're more focused on that than the very issues that we're talking about here on debt. There was another article that came out, and they were trying to say what changed in the political discourse that both parties now have gone from trying to rein in government debt, which is doubling with every single president, which is a scary thought in itself. I mean, you know, if Bush doubled it from 5 to 10, Obama doubled it from 10 to 20, who's the next president? Are they going to double it from 20 to $40 trillion? And we'll tell you why. That'll never happen because we will be in a full-blown financial crisis before that happened. But the change in the discourse has been, one reason is the economy did recover. And you have to give Obama credit for that. It's the worst economic recovery since World War II, but nonetheless, we came out of a recession. So when you come out of a recession, the economy expands, more tax revenues go to the government. And the other thing that changed is we're heading into election year. What do politicians like to do when they're running for office? They're going to tell the voters that they're going to give them a whole bunch of free stuff and make somebody else pay for it. So last November, both sides, Republicans and Democrats, got rid of the budget caps. And they said, we're just going to spend money. And this year, the deficit will go up by almost $200 billion. The other thing that has changed the discourse, and we'll talk about the real risk here, that we face as a country down the road, not immediately, but sooner or later, it could be the end of this decade or the next, is lower borrowing cost. And we've talked about this on the show. Even though the U.S. has $9 trillion more debt, they are spending less in interest expense, and we'll talk about the real danger about that. The national debt has doubled since 2007, but interest expense to the government has actually gone down. And the reason, I don't need to tell you, if you're an investor or you have money in a bank, you're seeing it. You're getting nothing on money market funds, you're getting nothing on CDs, and you're getting nothing on bond yields today. So the interest on the national debt, John, is now less than, it's a little over 1.25% of GDP. So politicians, unlike prudent financial people, are saying it's gotten better. Let's go out and spend a whole bunch of money. And that's what politicians do. And they don't put aside money for a rainy day so that when you do get into a recession, when tax revenues go down and expenditures go up, you don't have a reserve and you get into trouble. But what has changed is the government is able to spend a whole bunch of money, and they can do it and finance it at a low cost. And what this has led to is a false sense of security. I mean, we're going to have $10 trillion more debt when Obama leaves office next January. And we're still spending less money. So these politicians are saying, we've added all this debt, and look at it's not costing us that much. The problem is, as an article in the Wall Street Journal pointed out this week, in the next 10 years, by the year 2025, 100% of all government revenues are going to go to entitlements. There will be no money for national defense, there will be no money to pay interest on the debt, and there will be no money to actually run government. So in the next 10 years, less than 10 years from now, 100% of government revenues will go to entitlements. And John, can we play that clip from Larry Kotlikoff, where he talked about the unfunded liabilities of Social Security are $199 trillion. The Social Security Trust Fund said the liabilities went up by $6 trillion in just 1 year.
So you get the present value of all the spending that's projected by the CBO, and you get the present value of all the taxes projected by the CBO, and the difference is the fiscal gap, and it's the true red ink that the country faces. It's putting everything on the books. It's not leaving Social Security obligations and Medicare, Medicaid, and defense spending obligations all off the books because they're all there. You know, you have to pay for those things. It's not like we're never going to have a defense department or, you know, military. So we're $199 trillion in the red. So the country is dead broke. It's that $199 trillion is 53% of the present value of taxes. Another way of saying this is that we're 53% underfinanced, and we need a 53% immediate and permanent tax hike. And that number will go up to more like 70% if we wait 20 years. So our kids will face an even bigger disaster if we just sit back and say, oh, they'll handle it. So it's generational warfare, fiscal child abuse that we're involved in. Now, Social Security's fiscal gap, which is part of the 199, is today, according to the trustees report that you referenced, $32 trillion large. Last year, it was $26 trillion. So it actually grew by $6 trillion. That system is 32% underfinanced, according to this year's trustees report. Last year, it was 31% underfinanced. So we have a disaster with Social Security. It's part of a bigger disaster with our entire fiscal enterprise.
Well, you can see that the main beneficiary of low interest, well, it's not people who are savers and in certain forms of investment, but basically it's government, because with the lower interest rates, the government can issue more debt because it costs them less to service. Of course, there's always that sort of Damocles hanging over your head that what happens if suddenly interest for some reason rises, and that's a whole different issue. But that's why they do it. And so there's an incentive to keep on doing it, and the politicians can say we keep on spending, and that's the way it's running right now.
Well, and they're taking advantage. Spain just issued a 3-year bond with negative interest rates. Now, here's a country that has almost 25% unemployment. Their debt is growing rapidly, and they can finance their bonds at negative interest rates. In other words, you pay them to loan them money. Japan is considering issuing a 50-year bond. Japan, Switzerland, and Germany now have bonds at negative interest rates, meaning you paid the government to loan them money. And it's not just that the U.S. has benefited. All countries, you know, you take a look at the U.K., their interest expense has dropped by 35% over the last 5 or 6 years, even though their debt has gone up by 8%. And as we pointed out last week, with the unintended consequences, we just had CalPERS reported this week that a lot of these pension funds are hurting. They can't earn decent rate of returns to meet their pension liabilities. The unfunded pension liabilities of organizations and pensions like CalPERS, states, and municipalities amount, John, to trillions and trillions of dollars. And yet, if you look at the conventions this week, and it's not just here, it's overseas, with politicians, they're saying, we're going to spend a whole bunch more money, even though someday there's going to be a day of reckoning. And that's why this is all a confidence game. And that day of reckoning will come like it did in 2007, in 2009, when the financial actors in the market lose complete confidence and the whole system locks up and nobody trades because there's no liquidity. Nobody wants to sell to anybody because there's distrust and a loss of confidence. And it's all a game. And as long as confidence is maintained in the system, they can carry this on. But at some point in the future, the issue of debt, the interest on the debt, and we'll talk about in a moment here how this financial crisis is likely to unfold.
And you need to notice the dissonance that you're hearing in, and you and I both know, okay, the goal of politics is to win. And so it's usually done by a combination of truths, partial truths, and sometimes outright lies. But you had the Democratic convention this week saying that the economy is just fabulous. Last week's the Republicans said the economy is cruddy. And then we had the numbers come in this week. GDP is 1.2%, which is far below the 6%. So there's a real tension here between reality and what both political parties are telling us.
Well, and one of the reasons that is holding back economic growth, as Frank Holmes and I talked about in the first hour, it is taxation and regulation. And regulation is just another form of taxation. Just look at your utility bills, your cable phone bills, any kind of bills. They don't call it taxes. They call it fees. But it's one and the same. So we've seen in tremendous monetary activism in this economic recovery. We've seen increased regulations. And here's where the financial crisis, we're sowing the seeds of it. All of that regulation that came in with Dodd-Frank has made the markets less liquid. It does not take much to move the Treasury market, which is the largest bond market in the world. It used to take, you know, $500 million to move the Treasury market. Today, you can move the Treasury market with $100 million of trading. Because when they put Dodd-Frank in, it reduced the leverage of the banks, cut back on their trading departments, and the markets became more rigid, which makes them more susceptible in the financial crisis. And if you need to understand what happens in these kind of situations, I highly recommend reading Hyman Minsky when he talks about what happens in these financial crises. Liquidity locks up. In other words, nobody wants to trade, and it makes the financial crisis more severe. And if we look at the last financial crisis, it finally took the Fed, and I think the Bloomberg article talked about this was done about 2 years after the financial crisis through the Freedom of Information Act. They pried it open, and the Fed had to backstop $9 trillion worth of debt in trading. And so what happens when markets lock up like that? Nobody trusts the other person, so you don't want to do anything. You don't want to sell. There's liquidity evaporates, and when liquidity shrinks in the market, it accelerates the direction of the move to the downside. So you can see, like we did in 2008, where the markets would drop on 500, 1,000 point in a day because there's just no liquidity. There's a lot of sellers, but there's not no buyers. The other thing that has come out that nobody's paying much attention to, they brag about Dodd-Frank, it's made the system safer. Nothing could be further from the truth. The too big to fail banks got even bigger. They all gobbled up each other. So Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Citigroup, they're all bigger today as a result of the financial crisis than where they were before the financial crisis. But the big gorilla in the room, John, is the derivatives market, because the derivatives market is $650 trillion in value. Now, the derivative folks will tell you, well, it doesn't matter, because if you take a look at the net derivatives, in other words, if you net longs against shorts, it's only about, maybe $20 trillion, but that's not true. That's not the way the derivatives market works. And I'm going to explain what I mean. But I just want to explain for our listeners can understand how highly leveraged our big banks are. JP Morgan, and this is as of the end of 2015, JP Morgan had $232 billion in shareholder equity. They had assets of $2.6 trillion. So you're thinking, wow, pretty safe. Their derivatives are almost $64 trillion. The ratio of derivatives to shareholder equity is 275 times. And I'll tell you why that number is meaningful here in a minute. You take a look at Citigroup. They have $210 billion in equity. They have assets of $1.8 trillion. They have a derivative book of $56 trillion. They're leveraged 267 to equity. Goldman Sachs has a shareholder equity of about $83 billion. They have $856 billion in assets. Their derivative book is about $47 trillion. Goldman Sachs is leveraged 565 to 1. Bank of America has $243 billion in equity. They have $2.1 trillion in total assets. Their derivative book is about $37 trillion. They're leveraged 151 to 1. Now, one of the reasons the pro-derivative folks talk about, well, you really got to look at the net position. Now, let me explain what I mean by this and why they're looking at this from a wrong perspective. And let me give an example. Let's say I have a long position in the market that is $100 million, but I have a short position in the market, there's $80 million. So if I look at my net exposure, if I subtract $80 million of a short position from $100 million in a long position, then my net exposure to the market is only $20 million because I've hedged that $100 million by a short position of $80. Let me tell you why that doesn't work in a financial crisis. My short position of $80 million is only good if I can count on the people that I have shorted to honor their commitment when this market goes kapooey. And that's what happened in 2008. If it wasn't for the Fed backstopping the system to $9 trillion, a lot of these contracts would have been worthless. It was one of the reasons why the Fed had to bail out AIG and their derivatives to the tune of $200 billion. And that was just one firm. So the system, if you take a look at actual liabilities on a bank's balance sheet, like actual liabilities, what they owe other people, and you take a look at their equity, it looks pretty good. As the numbers I just mentioned, well, goodness, J.P. Morgan has $232 billion of shareholder equity on total assets of $2.5 trillion. That's not the problem. The problem is J.P. Morgan has $64 trillion in derivatives. They're leveraged 275-1. And the problem is, John, these guys at the top, as sharp as Jamie Dimon is, they don't understand the implications. It was like the infamous whale trade a couple of years ago where J.P. Morgan lost $6 billion in a matter of moments on one derivative trade alone. And that's where the real leverage is out there, because in the next financial crisis, the derivative market today is bigger than it was back in 2007. The too big to fail banks are bigger today than they were in 2007. So the next crisis where we're going to see the crisis emerge from is the derivative market in reaction to something that's taking place in the debt markets, because about 90% of all derivatives are interest rate related. So the bulk of the action is going to come in the credit markets related to debt issues of government and currencies, and the counterparties will be unable to perform on those contracts and will default, which will trigger a daisy chain event, much as it did in 2007 and 2009, but this time it'll be bigger. There's more derivatives, and the bigger banks have gotten bigger. And I just want to tell you, if you are a consumer and you think you've got a lot of money in the bank, take a look at what happened in the Cyprus crisis, the bail-in, where this time around, the public is not going to stand for a bailout of these financial institutions, and it's going to be the depositors that end up losing money. So you really need to think about what you're doing in your investments and why you need to pay attention to geopolitical events and what both parties are planning, because it's going to have an impact on the financial markets and the economy. And I can say this, John, they are not prepared for the next crisis.
And you would think, by the way, at some point or another, that our politicians would recognize that the central bankers don't seem to have a handle on it, because they've been wrong on their forecasts one time after the next. Remember that this last time the Fed was projecting 2.5% economic growth, and it turns out that, so far this year it's a little over 1%. So wrong again. But we base things on this, because they're always talking about this is data dependent. Wow, boy.
Well, one of the problems is the Federal Reserve is run by a group of basically economic professors who have never managed a business. None of them have ever sat on a trading desk or have a little understanding of how the real world works, and that includes our politicians. Rather than prompt people to spend, lower interest rates have led people to save more money. Rather than, let's say, promote sustainable economic growth, quantitative easing loaded the world with trillions of dollars of debt that is suffocating growth along with regulations. So the world is heading towards another financial crisis when the markets finally figure out that these policies will never produce the intended results and they cannot generate them. I mean, there's not been one Fed forecast that has been accurate. So it really gets down to a confidence game. The financial system is built on trust. It's built on, if you own a stock and you want to sell that stock, it's built that the system will work. When you go to sell that stock, there's going to be a buyer on the other end. It's built on trust that the government is going to be able to meet its debt obligations for paying interest. It's built on trust when you want to sell something that there is going to be a buyer. And as long as there is trust in the system, they can get by with it. And the problem was, at the end of the 70s, people didn't have trust in the system anymore. So they began to demand higher rates of return to compensate for risk. And that's how we got up to 15.5%. Inflation was running at 14%. I think we're going back, as we'll talk in the next segment, we're going back towards an inflationary economy with these helicopter drops. But in the 1980s, Volcker came in, raised interest rates, put the economy in two recessions, and he finally won the trust of the markets. Reagan came in and cut tax rates from 70% all the way down to 28%. The economy grew at 4 and 5% a year, and all of a sudden confidence is restored. But it takes a tremendous amount of effort and the right policies to make things work for the markets to regain that confidence. And that's why the Fed is playing a very dangerous game, and along with our politicians, because once that confidence is lost, it is one long road back to regain it. So it's not an easy thing to do once you lose that confidence, and that's why this is very precarious. They're walking a fine line of maintaining confidence. How many times have you listened to this program as we talked about the Fed? Are they or are they not? They tell you they are, and then 6 weeks later they change, they're not. Then they tell you, well, we're leaning in that direction, and then a month later or 2 months later they said, no, we're not. So the Fed is losing, and central banks are losing their credibility, but right now there's trust in the system. When the trust evaporates, that's going to be even more key. And that's why the IMF came out this week and said, what the heck are you central bankers doing? And what are you politicians doing? Do you need another crisis before you react? And it's amazing because it's not just here on the program. There's some very brilliant people out there. And I would highly recommend, there's two books. I'm reading one of them right now. Mohammed El Arian wrote a book called The Only Game in Town. It's about central banks, and he's basically saying they better get this next one right or this system, it could collapse. You also have Mervyn King, who's written a book called The End of Financial Alchemy, which is talking about central banks have run out of magic bullets. And then, of course, there is Michael Lewitt's book called The Committee to Destroy the World, Inside the Plot to Unleash a Super Crash on the U.S. Global Economy. And all of this is built around a confidence. And once that confidence is lost, and there's another element that we are facing in the next financial crisis that we did not face in the previous ones in 2000 and 2007.
What is that, Jim?
I would say probably for the first time, well, number one, the world is at war. You know, certain individuals don't want to admit we're at it, but Islamic terrorism is a war on the West. Call it what it is. It's asymmetric warfare, which is different. It's different than the past in the sense that it's not armies facing each other on the battlefield. It's fought from cities, and it's fought in the suburbs. It's fought in airports. It's fought in restaurant cafes and in soccer stadiums. And we have more geopolitical risk. An article on Wall Street Journal on Friday talking about Russia and China now developing joint military exercises in the Mediterranean and the South China Seas. John, you know, it's every single week now we're seeing terrorist attacks beginning, you know, with the attacks that happened in Germany, the attacks that happened last weekend with the bombing in Baghdad that killed 400 people, the beheading of a Catholic priest this week. It's every single week. The world is more destabilized and we're in a state of war, which makes financial risk even worse. It's almost like the scenario that we had in the 30s where we were unable to recognize the risk of fascism that was coming in with Hitler. And at the same time, our enemies are building their militaries. The U.S. is decommissioning its military from ships to troops to our nuclear triad. It's just absolutely amazing that we have not learned the lessons from history. You know, it reminds me, John, of something that Churchill said, the further back you look, the further forward you can see. And it's like we have absolutely not learned a thing from studying history. We're repeating the same mistakes. And that's why at some point in the future, and I think we'll see it in this decade, we're heading towards another financial crisis, and which is what the IMF came out this week and said, do you guys really need to have another financial crisis and another global recession before you guys act? And that's why you saw both in Cleveland and Philadelphia, both parties saying, well, we are going to act, and that's helicopter drops. And believe me, folks, they're coming, they're on their way, and they'll begin next year.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. 3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense NewsHour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense NewsHour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Joining us on the show today is Stratfor's Vice President of Global Analysis, Riva Gujan, to speak with us about their third quarter forecast. And Riva, I don't know about you, but it seems like there is a lot going on recently, perhaps more than it seems is normal. We have the landmark Brexit decision that just took place last month. There was the ruling against China's disputed territories in the South China Sea. That was a major decision, a major terror attack in Nice, France on Bastille Day. Venezuela looks like there's just massive unrest and social chaos over there. And of course, there was a failed coup in Turkey. So there is not any limit to things that we can discuss today. But perhaps we can start with one of the big things that a lot of people are looking at is post-Brexit impacts upon Europe. Why don't you tell our audience a little bit about what Stratfor is expecting in the months ahead there?
Well, the Brexit vote, you know, of course, that is going to be a big catalyst when we've been talking about this trend of Europe fragmenting. This is, of course, going to accelerate that process. You know, it was hard to say that this would be the vote that would trigger everything and that this would be when the UK says, okay, I'm headed for the door. But we always knew that in any future map of Europe, that the UK would be among the first to leave. Now, what that means for the rest of Europe is much more interesting, I think, because we're looking at the economic uncertainty over the UK's departure. That's just kind of like a big black cloud hanging over the continent. And so that can unleash a lot of different concerns that have had lids on them for a while. So when we look at the southern European periphery, lots of unfinished business there. And of course, Italy is in the spotlight with stress tests approaching, the banking sector still in a lot of trouble, Matteo Renzi negotiating for state aid to be given to its troubled banks. But from Germany's perspective, you know, they just rewrote the rules, the bail-in rules, and they don't want that immediately violated. I think we're going to see some compromise after the stress test to allow state aid to Monte dei Paschi. But beyond that, you know, this is still a very troubling prospect for the Germans. And this is where we've been talking about Europe fragmenting, and you have north-south divisions. You also have east-west divisions. That north-south division becomes so important as you watch how France is becoming more nationalist, more Eurosceptic. You have the National Front still very strong. These terrorist attacks only fuel that Eurosceptic sentiment as well. And so people calling for referendums of their own. And France is going to Spain, going to Portugal, going to Italy, saying, you know what, I agree with you. The European Commission is being unfair. I think the finance minister even said it's being mean to these countries. And so France is identifying with the southern periphery in opposition to Germany and the northern bloc. And that is a divide that's only going to grow more and more. So in the shorter term, you know, Germany is still going to try to work with France. They're still going to meet a lot, but you have other countries in between, especially the Netherlands, which is always really key to watch because the Netherlands always likes to kind of play the bad cop to Germany where they'll say things that maybe the German mainstream leadership isn't prepared to say. And the Netherlands will kind of push Germany tighter into this northern bloc that's been forming. So that's something to watch overall. I just think that the overall fragmentation trend is still very strong. And in the wake of Brexit, everybody's going to be throwing out their own referendum on how to re-engineer the EU. The problem is nobody can agree fundamentally on what the new blueprint should look like.
You know, I was thinking in the last segment, Jim, you know, we talk about history repeating or rhyming. And of course, the famous quote from George Santayana, those who do not know history are condemned to repeat it. But the very first lesson that history teaches us is that 90% of the people will not learn the lessons of history. You can actually count on it. And so that's the first lesson of history, you know. And what that means, I guess, is you have to be wise. When the herd's running one way, you run the other way. But you should count on that. Anyway, we have been in a disinflationary environment for 35 years, but not everything lasts forever. And how long can we assume that we are going to see a change in the trend, moving from deflation to inflation?
Since 1981, the general trend in the markets for interest rates has been falling. Now, a lot of technicians and some on the fundamental side, including myself, thought that the summer of 2012, when bond yields on treasuries got down, I'm talking about the 10-year treasury note, got down to about 1.6%, that was the bottom of the bond market. And then, of course, we hit 1.36% just a couple of weeks ago. And I think the difference is, John, is now QE has gone global. It just wasn't the Fed. And the problem with that, and why you've seen these interest rates drop even further, is the United States right now currently is the best oasis in the world. I mean, you may not think that 1.5% on a U.S. Treasury yield is very much until you look at negative interest rates in Germany, Switzerland, or you look at lower interest rates in Spain and Portugal, or negative interest rates in Japan. So all this money that's looking for a place to park anytime there's a crisis, whether it's Brexit or as the war on terrorism grows almost like on a weekly basis now. I mean, we're getting terrorist attacks here in my own city of San Diego. We had two cops shot on Thursday night. One was killed. So it is violence, whether it's coming from terrorism or groups that are against police. I mean, it's escalating. And eventually, we are turning the tide. As we talked about in the last topic, governments, as a result of populism, now are now moving to spend money. So we are now at an inflection point. And yes, yields have gone lower than anybody anticipated, and they still may do that. If we have another crisis in the next couple months, what will happen? Money will rush out of stocks, they'll rush out of banks, it'll rush into the bond market, which could drive yields lower. But at some point, and this is the inflection point, is when the markets wake up and they lose confidence in our institutions, whether it was the loss in the presidency under Jimmy Carter, the loss of confidence in the Fed under Arthur Burns or Miller. There was a loss of confidence in politics and a loss of confidence in the financial markets. Now, so far, that hasn't quite happened, although you're starting to see it happen in the political sphere, which is why you've seen the movement of populism this year, whether it's Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders or Brexit or other movements around the world. But eventually, we are heading towards higher yields and higher inflation because populism is gone global. It's gone to Europe. It's moving in Japan. It's moving in Latin America. It's moving in the United States. It's moving in Canada. And it's forcing policymakers to embrace reinflation.
Well, if we're talking about helicopter money, then I guess a real short-circuiting question here would be, what does that mean for investors?
All of this stuff is creating uncertainty. But counteracting that uncertainty is the world is awash with money. All this money that the Fed created by expanding its balance sheet by $4 trillion. I think global central banks have expanded liquidity by like $28 trillion. So the world is awash in liquidity due to central bank policies. The problem is companies are in no mood to spend money. They're spending more money on regulation. The demand, one of the characteristics, if you look at this corporate earnings report for the second quarter, this is the fifth quarter that you've seen corporate earnings decline. If you look at the second quarter GDP number that came in on Friday at 1.2% versus, let's say, expectations for 2.6, one of the biggest weaknesses was commercial and residential investments. Companies aren't investing. There's too much uncertainty. There's too much taxes. There's too much regulations. There just isn't the growth in the economy. You're not going to spend money if your sales aren't going up. Why are you going to build a new plant and equipment when you don't have the demand for your goods? It just isn't happening. And another trend that is structural, John, is we're seeing aging demographics globally. It's not just here in the United States. As boomers age and get older, the over 65 population is increasing and becoming a larger percentage of the national population, not just here in the United States. Actually, it's better here in the United States than it is in Europe or in China or even in Japan. Aging demographics, what does that mean? More healthcare expenditures, less spending, and it's more government deficits. So what you're going to see, as the Wall Street Journal article talked about, between now and the year 2025, entitlements, Social Security and Medicare, are going to take up 100% of the government's budget. There will be no money left over from taxation to pay interest on the debt. And imagine what the debt will be in another 10 years when it's been doubling under every president. There will be no money to run defense, and there will be no money left to run government. So the only thing that will be left will be how governments get rid of debt. They do it a couple ways. They inflate it, they default on it, or they debase their currency. And so one of those three items, the fourth is growth. And I'm sorry, but as we've seen in these economic numbers, the worst recovery since World War II, they're not going to be able to grow their way out. Debt is growing faster than economic growth rate. And that is a collision course, which is why we talked about a financial crisis in the last decade. And if you take a look at the efforts by policymakers to avert deflation, whether it's quantitative easing, whether it's ZIRP, zero interest rate policy, or NERP, negative interest rate policy, none of that has worked. So they're basically in a reaction to populism. It's just like the Roman emperors back in the days of Rome. It's bread and circuses for the masses to be paid for with inflationary money. And you're probably the first area that we could see react to this, to helicopter money. Remember, folks, when politicians deny they're going to do something, that's usually the first clue they're getting ready to do it. They'll deny it up to the moment they do it. And probably the first area that we're going to see helicopter drops is going to be in Japan. The UK is moving in that direction, and the US will move in that direction next year, no matter who the president is, whether it's Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. And that is the next move, and why I think we're moving from this disinflationary environment to an inflationary environment. We still have a lot of global slack. We have weak economic growth. But the next response is going to be government spending money to inject that money in the economy. And then the central bank will just simply print the money.
Well, most of the professionals, Jim, I'm sure, understand what we mean by helicopter money. Obviously, this is an allegory or a metaphor. And we're talking about lots of money printing and literally just dumping it in. Now, explain that, the mechanics of that.
Let's just make this simple in mathematical terms. Let's say the government spends $1 million a year. And on that $1 million a year, they take in $60 million of tax revenues, and then they issue $40 million in debt. Now let's decide that isn't working. So what the government does is say, all right, we're going to increase spending from $100 million a year. We're going to increase spending to, let's say, $1.3 million a year. So we're going to spend $30 million more than we normally do to stimulate the economy. Well, they don't get that in tax revenue. So what they do is they just turn to the central bank, and the central bank just prints the money to buy the government debt. But in the meantime, what the government has done is they're going to spend an extra $30 million, and that adds to GDP growth. You know, depending on how they do it in terms of philosophy, you know, if you take the Democrat socialist model, they would simply just raise taxes and take money from one group of people and give it to the other group of people. The problem is you don't really increase economic growth that way. The other one would be simply tax cuts. But what would happen is the deficits would go up and the central bank would simply print the money to buy the government debt. And that's what we call helicopter money. And the reason that is coming next is, once again, as the IMF has been calling for, they're saying, look, monetary policy can't do it alone. Monetary policy is most effective when it's combined with fiscal policy, kind of what the United States did and what Obama did and the Fed did coming out of the financial crisis in March of 2009. The Fed announced QE1. In March of 2009, Obama got his economic stimulus package, which, you know, basically he spent $1 trillion, and the Fed said, we're going to print $1 trillion. So basically the Fed was going to print the money to pay for the stimulus. And that's what lies ahead, because the populist movement is forcing governments in this. It's basically the public is saying, we need bread and circuses, and that's what they're doing. And certainly, you know, what I call the government media is keeping everybody entertained with he said, she said, instead of focusing on the real issues of this political campaign, which should be economic policy. What they're doing is going with all this feel-good stuff, and they're focusing on, well, Donald Trump said this, Hillary Clinton said this. They're not focusing on overall issues that are facing us. in the fact that we are at war and we are heading towards a bigger war that's ahead of us, which makes the financial situation even more precarious in the next downturn.
Well, again, back to that question, what does this mean for investors? Because, you know, we've been bouncing back and forth between risk off, risk on, risk off, risk on. I think we were risk off at the beginning of the year. Now we're at risk on. We're still back to that question. How does an investor function in this kind of an environment?
You're going to have to be very adaptive. I mean, you know, the way we manage money, we are sticking with short-term corporate bonds because we do believe we're at that pivot point in our opinion right now that we're moving from a disinflationary environment to inflationary. So you got to be prepared. You've got to be adaptive. And right now, you almost have to take a barbell approach where your portfolio has assets in it that are working well with what I call the risk-off trade. And you have assets in your portfolio, they're working well with the risk on trade. So you have to have a balance between the two because quite honestly, John, you don't know what's going to happen next. I mean, look what happened with Brexit. They thought it wasn't going to happen, then it did. The markets lost 1,000 points and everybody said, wait a minute, it's going to take a longer time for that to really play out. And so then we went on to the risk on trade because immediately following Brexit, every central bank from the Bank of England started injecting money in the economy. Because if you take a look at what's driving this market, we just hit a record this week with the S&P. Earlier today, we hit 2175, which is an all-time record for the S&P 500. Can you say that that was driven by economic growth or was that driven by corporate earnings? No. This is the fifth consecutive quarter of declining corporate earnings. So it's not earnings that are driving the stock market. And then on this Friday, when we got second quarter GDP, it's 1.2%. Once again, half of what the Fed is predicting for growth rates this year. It's not economic growth. It is just simply money that is sloshing around the globe looking for a place to land. And the problem is, when they inject this money, the markets react. Okay, they're putting money into the economy. The Fed's printing money. The Bank of England's printing money. This is safer for us. So then the markets take off and we hit new records as we're doing now. Then we'll get into another crisis. Who knows where the next crisis will be? Whether it's Japan, probably Europe with the Italian banking system. It could be major terrorist attacks. You know, like I mentioned, my own city of San Diego, we had two cops shot, one of them killed on Thursday night. Who knows what it's going to be? Then you go back to the risk off trade. And when that happens, money rushes out of stocks. It goes into the bond market, driving bond yields lower as it did accompanying the Brexit vote. And so that's why you almost have to have this barbell approach between risk on and risk off assets until we get a firm change in trend, meaning that we move from a disinflationary environment straight into an inflationary environment. And that's where we are right now. You picture a teeter-totter, we're right there. We're at a pivot point, and we are going to be shifting more towards inflation. And that's what I think the gold market is sniffing out. I think that's why we saw the assets that we saw this year in the rise in gold, silver, the rise in oil, though oil's pulled back. I don't expect that to stay. I think you're going to see a shift more into tangible assets as we move closer towards an inflationary environment and moving away from a deflation. Because as we discussed last week with Ben Bernanke's helicopter speech from November of 2002, a central bank in a fiat system can always create inflation. Now, a lot of you might say, well, why haven't they done that so far with all these problems? The reason they haven't done it is they're trying to maintain confidence. If the Fed was just to go out and just say, we're just going to print a whole bunch of money and we don't give a darn about inflation, they would lose credibility with the financial markets. And once they lose credibility of the central bank, game over. Once the confidence game is over, John, it took Paul Volcker 2 or 3 years, Ronald Reagan 2 or 3 years before confidence was eventually restored in the economic system in the United States, in the financial system, in the Federal Reserve. And so it's all a matter of confidence. But basically, that's why right now you've got to take a barbell approach because, you know, who knows what the next crisis is going to be or what the market's going to worry. You know, every single year we worried about something. At the beginning of the year, we were worried about Chinese growth. We were worried about economic growth in the U.S. And we were worried about, you know, geopolitical issues, but mainly it was economic growth. And the result was as you've seen, the markets went down 6 weeks in a row. And then all of a sudden, Japan went to negative interest rates. Janet Yellen changed her tune. And we've been on the risk on trade ever since. There was about a two-week period in May and early part of June. But as a result of the Brexit vote, what did central banks do? They responded to the crisis. They flooded the market's liquidity. And here we are on this Friday with the S&P 500 touching at 2175, another all-time record, for the month of July in the markets. Once again, not driven by economic growth. Economic growth is 40% of where they expected it to be. And it certainly isn't corporate earnings, because corporate earnings are in a downtrend and have been in a downtrend for almost five quarters. And if you take a look at what companies are saying about Q3 and Q4, I think the next couple of quarters, you'll see that continuous downtrend as the economy, both globally and here, begins to slow down.
So how does one play that, Jim? I mean, if you talk about a barbell approach, that may be familiar to you, but people listening might not quite understand how this works out in reality.
John, if you just take a look at some of the acronyms that we've come up for stocks that have led the sector. Last year, it was FANG, which stood for Facebook, Apple, Netflix, and Google. And what the market was saying is, in this slow growth environment, which has been exhibited throughout this economic recovery, just as the, you know, on Friday, the press talked about, this is the worst and slowest economic recovery since World War II. And so the markets will pay for growth. And that's why the valuations of Facebook, Apple, Netflix, and Google are as high as they are, because in a slow growth world, as we see today, investors will pay more for that growth. So you have FANG. So FANG would kind of represent the risk on trade, because you're basically putting money into higher growing companies. The acronyms that you've seen this year is STUB, which stands for staples, telecoms, utilities, and bonds. That's what has worked the best this year. And then you also have to take a look at this transition as we move more from disinflation to inflation. What have you seen done the best this year? The best performing asset by far, nothing even comes close to it, has been gold stocks. Many are up 100 and 200% this year. And the price of precious metals, whether you're looking at silver or gold. So you have STUB. And let me throw one more acronym towards you, and it's TINA. There is no alternative, because, John, I firmly see, before we get to the next bubble, when it burst in the next financial crisis, it'll be, I mean, dividend yields, you can look at Coca-Cola, Procter & Gamble, Exxon, just look at any of the big Dow stocks, Microsoft, Intel. The dividend yields are twice what you can get in a 10-year treasury bond. So people that are seeking safety, that are looking for income and trying to survive, are you going to buy a 10-year treasury at 1.5%? Are you going to buy a 10-year Swiss government bond and pay the Swiss government 1.1% a year to own that bond? In other words, you'd lose about 12% over a 10-year period. I don't think so. So that's what TINA stands for. There is no alternative right now. What are you going to do? Are you going to put your money in cash that's negative? You know, I was meeting one of my clients, referred me their parents. They were sitting with $500,000 in a money market fund and another $400,000 in a bank account. The money market fund was paying 0.01%. Their bank CD was paying them a little over 0.5%. They didn't know what to do. They never invested in the financial markets. They always had CDs all their life, put their money, you know, it was FDIC insured, and they stuck with that throughout their retirement years. Well, you know, it worked okay in the 90s, worked part of the time in the last decade, but it certainly isn't working now. Where are you going to put your money when you have interest rates that are negative? I mean, imagine if you were to take your net worth and basically say, well, I'm going to take my net worth and I'm going to loan it to the government and I'm going to pay them for it. If you want to see what the barbell approach is, just take a look at those acronyms, FANG, STUB, and TINA. And that pretty much defines this market. And so that's why you have to be flexible. I read a book by Louis Gav at GavCal Research, and it was something that he learned from one of his mentors that is so reflective of our industry, the financial industry. And that is, money managers are paid to adapt, not to forecast. I mean, how many forecasts have you seen go wrong these last 7-8 years, beginning with the government itself, the Federal Reserve, or Wall Street? Here we are We got second quarter GDP, first estimates, there's usually three, instead of 2.6%, which was the consensus estimates, including the Fed's, we came in at 1.2%. So what your job as an investor is, forget forecasting and forget your political views. I don't care if you're independent, a Republican or Democrat. You have to be apolitical if you want to be an investor. You know, I don't like President Obama's economic policies, but that didn't stop us from investing in stocks. It's been one of the best stock market bull markets that we've had in the last 100 years. So you have to adapt to what the markets present to you rather than take your political views and say, well, I disagree with what the president's doing, or I disagree with Trump, I disagree with Hillary. It doesn't matter if you disagree. Your job as an investor is to figure out what their policies are going to have and which way they're going to impact the market and invest accordingly. And that's what you're going to have to be doing going forward.
Well, here we are. We are in silly season. And now we're going to get down to the real substantive debates between Mrs. Clinton and Mr. Trump. And we'll see what they're proposing and how well these things stand up in a verbal clash. Maybe we'll have a little more concrete ideas. That's going to continue until November. But one thing is very sure, that we're in some really major changes here right now. And so far, we haven't heard either political party address these, but they will be breaking loose on the watch of whomever is elected as the next president.
Yeah, and we're going to see that. Like I say, usually the markets, the big boys take off and head to the Hamptons for the summer. And the real ball game begins in September after summer is over. The big guys will be back on Wall Street and we'll be in full campaign mode. And this is going to be interesting. And this was something Tom McClellan talked about in the first hour. The markets start paying more attention in September and October. That's why Tom thinks that we could be heading into a downturn, bottoming sometime in September and October, because what will happen is the big boys come back from the Hamptons. They start taking a look at, okay, what are the polls telling us? Who is going to be the likely next president of the United States? There's this uncertainty, which will create some turbulence in the market. Once the market figures it out, it's a rally point into the inauguration day of the next president. Then afterwards, as Tom talks about, all the tough decisions are made in the early days of the presidency, just like you saw Obama get all his things passed, his stimulus bill passed within 90 days. The Fed started its launch. So a lot of this stuff, and the market will try to figure it out. In the meantime, it'll create some uncertainty. But, you know, it'll probably be a slow summer outside of terrorist attacks every single week, depending on how bad they get, or police shootings, as happened in my own city on Thursday night. These things, have you noticed that they're not having much of an impact? They are happening so frequently that it's almost like, well, first of all, the media doesn't cover it, and it's becoming immune to it. So anyway, the real action, I think, is going to begin as we head into the fall, as we get closer to the election date of November, as we start the debates. And then also, as we get into the third quarter, we're going to see if this continuous slow trend in the economy that we've been talking about since the beginning of the year, because we think we could be heading into a recession next year, unless the next president comes right out of the gate and says, you know what, we're putting forth a $1 trillion spending program, and the Fed basically monetizes it. That would postpone a recession. Unless that action is taken, we are likely to head into recession, as these economic numbers are showing. Instead of 2.6% economic growth, we got those GDP numbers for the second quarter on Friday, a 1.2%, and then also second quarter earnings continuing to decline for the fifth quarter in a row. But the action begins this summer. But you never know, John. You know what happens every time you and I take off in August? Something always happens.
No, nothing is going to happen this year. We are going away. I refuse to allow it happen, and I will be extremely upset if it does. And I will complain to the president and to the new candidates.
Oh, okay. Well, I feel so much better now.
Don't you? Yes.
Yeah, I do. Well, in the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.